Today is June 27th, 2008. We are at the Amelia Island Museum of History, 233 South 3rd Street in Fernandina Beach, Florida. The following interview is being conducted as part of the Amelia Island Museum of History's Veterans History Project in partnership with the Library of Congress. Today we are interviewing Commander Kenneth Alexander Mertz, Jr., Dental Corps, United States Navy, retired. Commander Mertz was born on November 20th, 1952, in Point Pleasant, New Jersey. My name is Don Hill, and I will interview Commander Mertz on behalf of the Amelia Island Museum of History. Assisting me today is Gerhard Tam, who will operate the recording equipment. Also in attendance is Doug Mackle, who is sitting in as an observer. I will now begin the interview. Commander, I noticed that you didn't enter the service until you were nearly 28 years old. Could you tell us where you were, what you were doing, why you went in the service, and maybe from that point forward, tell us of your wonderful 22-year Navy career, if you would, sir.
Well, I graduated from high school in 1971 and went off to college knowing that I had known since third grade that I was going to be some sort of a doctor. And my first year of college, the person who became one of my best friends, father was a dentist, and I attended the Greater New York City Dental Convention and found out that this was the ideal mix for me. I love doing things and making things, but you get the medical side at the same time. And graduated from college. I went to graduate school for a year and then began dental school all at Fairleigh Dickinson University in New Jersey. And the one thing I realized during college, and particularly during dental school, was I wasn't all excited about going back to Bricktown, New Jersey. Not that it's a bad place, but I spent all of my childhood there, and I didn't think going back to lovely Bricktown, New Jersey to set up a practice was the way my future was going to be.
Is Bricktown just another name for Mount Pleasant, or is that a real town?
Well, Mount Pleasant is different. Point Pleasant is... Point Pleasant is on the beach, just south of Asbury Park. Uh-huh. And going a little bit west is Bricktown, where I was raised, went to high school. And interesting, I went back there in late 01 when my mother was sick. And boy, has it changed dramatically. But when I was in dental school, I applied for a Navy scholarship, and while I wasn't offered the scholarship, I was offered a job. So I said, let's go in the Navy for a couple years and see what we can do, and 3 years ended up turning to 21 and a half. My first duty station was in Norfolk, Virginia, at a place we called the Big House because it was one of the largest dental clinics probably in the world now. After they moved out of the old building into the new one, there was like 105 treatment rooms. So you don't find too many places with that many dental chairs in at the same place.
Was that at the main Navy operating base in Norfolk?
Exactly, NOB Norfolk. But during that first year, I worked for an awesome admiral, Admiral John Holmes, and his number two, Captain Al Herr, it's like German hair, H-E-R-R. And they just gave me all kinds of neat opportunities. How about if you go over here? How about if you do this for a couple weeks? How about if you do that? So I'd been in the Navy 6 months when they asked me to go work aboard a ship, the USS California, which is a cruiser, guided missile cruiser. And we took field equipment and went on the ship and went out to sea for a couple weeks and worked in the pitching, tossing seas off the Virginia operating area. Came back, they asked me to take over a small clinic at the Armed Forces Staff College. And so that was a one-holer there. So it was me and the chaplain down the hall and our softball team, and we had a great time. And
can I take you back just a pause for a moment?
Sure.
When you went in the service, when you finally got your commission, did you go in like as a JG as opposed to an ensign because of your education?
I actually went in as a lieutenant.
A full lieutenant.
As an O3. They
wow.
Really want to get into the legislation? When I went in 1980, we got credit for 4 years of dental school. So instead of coming as an ensign, he came as a lieutenant, and I came in as an 03 over 4 for pay.
Okay.
So when I retired at 21 and a half, my retired pay was calculated on 25 and a half. After September 15th, 1981, when a thing called DOPMA, Defense Officer Planning Management Act, came into effect, they came in as 03s under 2, and that was a bunch of $1,000 a year difference in pay. And not to be overly political, but I think that had an effect on retention, because a lot of people that I came in with between 79 and 81, we were friends for years.
Sure.
And other people much later came in with, of course, higher school loans and things like that, and the long-term retention was not as good.
So now you're in as a lieutenant right off the bat, 03, and you've been out to sea on California, and now you've come back and you're at
the Armed Forces Staff College.
A one-holer, as you put it.
Well, it's a had two chairs, one desk, and me, and one dental technician, and it was a 6-month school for 04 level line officers of all services. I wasn't part of the program, so I wasn't allowed to sit in on the classes. Most of them were classified anyway, so none of my business. But I was there for a while, and then I found out that instead of being in Norfolk for 3 years like I thought, I was up for orders. And when the detailer, the assignment officer, said, where would you like to go? Which I was surprised at that. I said, well, I've been told that my best move would be to get a ship, and I would like one out of here if at all possible. And if we could wait until after the end of August, that would be fantastic, because I was involved with the Dentistry Merit Badge through the Boy Scouts at the National Jamboree. And he said, how about November? So I flew out of Norfolk and arrived aboard USS Nimitz in the middle of the Gulf of the Mediterranean the day before Thanksgiving in 1981. I completed one Mediterranean cruise, a short yard period, another complete 6-month deployment of 183 days. And then left the ship. I went back to the base there in Norfolk. 2 years later, I was in Bethesda doing a 2-year advanced training program in dentistry called the Comprehensive Dentistry Program. And I mentioned to another senior officer who was now the detailer that we had visited the Marine Corps Command and Staff College in Quantico, and I said, you know, someday it'd be great. It looks like a great school to go to. And I got a phone call one day, and he said, I put your name in. They accepted you. If you want to go, you can go to the school. So I went to this incredible 10.5-month school in Quantico, where there was one other dentist and myself and about 130 or 40 Marine majors, equivalent rank people from about 30 different countries. And I mean, Kenya, Somalia, Norway, I mean, any major, Saudi Arabia. I mean, we had Israelis, we had Argentines, which was I thought was kind of interesting, because it was right after what I always called the Malvinas, but the, what was that? The
Falklands.
Falklands, exactly. So it depends on if you're Argentine or Malvinas.
Yeah.
So, but we had the Argentine in the class, and we had the Israeli in the class, and we had
the Brits, no doubt.
Oh, Brits too. Were there. Yep. So, I mean, and everybody was very professional.
You know. What was the curriculum? What was the leadership?
It was a leadership, how to fight battalions, almost brigade level forces in a war, and war planning tactics. A lot of meeting, very interesting people. I got to meet Medal of Honor winner and a couple of Navy Cross winners. You know, you stand in awe of people with that kind of thing. And very nice people, of course. Got to meet the Chief of Naval Operations and just a bunch of things. And I learned what my job would be as a dental officer / medical department officer, because our job was to support them. I'm not going to lead combat troops, but I could sit down and understand their planning and their orders and their charts and know, well, if I'm going to be available for casualties, I can be here, I can't be there, and all that kind of thing. And I was disappointed, particularly during the first Gulf War, that I didn't get a chance to put that to work. But, you know, if you got to go to war, somebody's got to be there.
At this point, had you decided upon a naval career?
Well, when I went back to Norfolk in 1983, I started a series of night courses, which the Navy paid portions of through tuition assistance. So when I finished that, as an officer, I was obligated to stay on active duty another 2 years. Then I went to the two-year training program, and I owed them another 2 years. And then I went to Command and Staff College, and I owed them another 2 years. So by the time my payback was done, I had 11.
You were a career man.
And I picked up lieutenant commander in 86, early 87. And by the time I had 11 years, I was coming into the zone for commander. And I was at Camp Pendleton by then. I spent 4 years at Camp Pendleton, a little over a year with the actual Marines, and the other 3 years in support on we call it the blue side. Then I begged to get back to the East Coast, and they sent me to Charleston, where I was assigned to the USS Sierra, AD-18, as a destroyer tender out of Charleston. And we spent half the time getting ready for its final deployment and the rest of the time decommissioning the ship. And we decommissioned her. She had 49 years of active service. And was sort of interesting. The Navy came out with what they call the Medical Department Surface Warfare. It's actually called the Surface Warfare Medical Department Officer, something like that. Everybody liked it because it said SWIMDU was the acronym. And and I thought that was a very important thing. You had to get knowledge of the ship, the engineering, the whatever the ship did, you really had to understand all that. So I guess without patting myself too much on the back, I am the one and only Surface Warfare Medical Officer from the Sierra.
Well done, sir.
And unfortunately, we decommissioned the ship after I was only there for 13 months. But while I was there, and I joined the ship when it was in Miami doing Hurricane Andrew relief, went back. I was in Charleston for a while. Then they were doing some maneuvering of clinics and opening and closing and condensing and doing the things they do every few years. And they said, well, we can't leave you in Charleston, but we can bring you back if you'll go to Cuba for us. So I went to Cuba on what was supposed to be 12 months, ended up being 15 months, during the tail end of what they called the migrant situation in 95, 96. And we had a huge number of people on the base. And for the most part, things were quiet. And I have some pictures in here I'd be happy to show you, but it's kind of interesting. You have the only American base in the middle of communist territory. And you're surrounded by open area, ring guard towers, big tall fence, a no man's zone in between, another fence, and the Cuban guard towers. Except the Cuban guards face Cuba, because they want to make sure people aren't trying to escape Cuba and get onto the base. And in between, there were two minefields. One was the Cuban minefield, which was apparently never maintained, and ours. And I think because President Clinton, shortly after that, I think ordered all those minefields removed, so I don't think they're there anymore, which is not necessarily a bad thing. But we'd occasionally get people in the hospital who had snuck over the fence and triggered a Cuban mine, and they usually weren't seriously injured but full of splinters. So some of my physician's friends would spend hours plucking little things out and putting in three or four stitches, and a woman physician I knew down there said she spent 4 or 5 hours and put in several hundred stitches on somebody. Let's see, so after that, I went back to the Charleston area, and I spent a year or so as kind of the rover guy, and it was, to me, all this stuff is great fun. A lot of people didn't like this, but I spent 1 week working at the Air Force Base, 1 week working at the Naval Hospital, 1 week at the weapons station at Goose Creek, and I just sort of rotated around for months. And then they needed some fill-in help down at Mayport, so I went down there for 6 weeks. And then a friend of mine ran the base up at Kings Bay and said, you know, I could really use you up here. And they said, well, we'll transfer you as long as it doesn't cost us any money.
Ah.
And I said, that's fine, because I was single at the time. I had no trouble packing up my few things in a small U-Haul and making a trip.
From Mayport to Kings Bay.
Well, actually from Goose Creek.
Oh, okay.
And moved down there. I rented a small house in St. Mary's for a while. And it was at that point that I realized it's getting close to retirement time. And I was very proudly, I'm an operational guy. I love being out. I'd rather be on a ship or under a tent than pretty much anywhere. I get itchy if I sit in the same place for too long. And my boss and I, we were good friends, but every once in a while we would dig each other, you know, in the teasing sort of way. And one day he came by my office and said, do you know how to spell Haiti? And I said, sure. He said, it's good because you're going. And he good. Thought he was going to get me upset. And I said, great, when do I leave? So 6 months later, after a bunch of training, I went with the Fleet Hospital Jacksonville down to Port-au-Prince, Haiti, where we spent 6 months from January to the end of June in 99. And that was what I call the best and worst 6 months I had in the Navy. I got to participate. I mean, the dentists don't get to do a lot of real medical stuff. But I got to participate in some amazing surgeries and help with people. And I mean, I could tell you a bunch of stories. The kid I called the kid with two knees, because his legs were broken right above his knees, and they fixed him. You know, kid who had an infection in his bone who should have died, and they fixed him. You know, it was just amazing.
Wonderful.
But we were also in a convoy, and the truck behind me, a deuce and a half, got hit by a cement truck and flipped over. And two of my young hospital corpsmen were killed. And it, you know, many of us in the service have been in that situation where you have to sit there and hold the hand of somebody as their heart stops. So that made it the worst part. There's still a Garth Brooks song that I stop. Why can't they
hear it?
When I name it, but one of our nurses sang that song at the memorial ceremony. So now, whatever I'm doing, I pull off the road or whatever when that song comes.
Sure.
The dance it was called. So I got back from Haiti and married a woman I had only met several months ago that we spent most of the time corresponding on the computer. But all of the quirky little stuff was the same. It was kind of scary. So we got married in August of 99, and I was up at Kings Bay, and they wanted me to go work at boot camp up in Great Lakes. And that's
a PCS, a permanent change of station?
Yeah. And working in that sort of environment is not my kind of deal. It's high productivity. You don't get to really meet your patients very much. Plus, it's in that thing they call cold. They got snow and stuff up there.
Don't they?
And I decided years ago, if I want to see snow, I'll just disconnect the cable on my TV. So, and the Navy was actually beginning to draw down. Numbers were changing and things. So they were looking for a few people like me to retire anyway. And the places that I would have loved to have gone, like Scotland or Europe, the people who were working there didn't want to leave, which is why I wanted to go there.
Or those stations were closed down before you could get there.
Right. So I said, you know, I really don't want to do this boot camp thing. And so we agreed it was time to retire.
And that was in 2002.
Right. I always say 02. It's actually February 1st, but...
May I take you back on a couple of things,
sure,
please, if
all
I may?
Over the place.
Tell me of your, if you would, a little bit more in detail of your deployment on Nimitz. For instance, I'd be interested in knowing, I think, the people who hear this audio, how many dentists were out there? And
The ship has approximately 5,000 or a little more total people on it when it's deployed, around 100 aircraft, and there are five dentists.
Five.
And one of them, the department head, was an oral surgeon. We had a fully trained prosthodontist to do bridges and dentures and stuff, and then three general dentists to do everything else.
And is the dental department still subordinate to the medical department? Does the
no? Well, that's changed again. At the time, they were equal to separate departments. Until we went into a general quarters type situation, at which time we became part of the medical department. Mm-hmm. And one of my jobs was we had a physician who happened to be a flight surgeon, and me and a chaplain, two dental technicians and two hospital corpsmen, and we ran flight deck battle dressing station during general quarters.
That's the kind of thing, though, that you no doubt volunteered for. A dentist wouldn't normally be up there, or would he
right.
or she?
Right. And I fought for that.
Right.
And so my job was triage, which fortunately I never had to do other than in training, and load people onto the deck edge elevators and ride with them down to the hangar bay. So I did get to do that. That was kind of fun. I arrived on the ship my first time on what they call a COD, a carrier onboard delivery two propeller high wing airplane. So I legally have one official trap. And so I think I could become a tail hook member, but with all the controversy of I decided I didn't need that card in my pocket. We spent the vast majority of both cruises in what they call the Eastern Mediterranean off the coast of Beirut and Israel. Made port calls in places like Israel. I have about 4 hours in Egypt. Because other than that, the nice days I had duty and the days I was off, we had foul weather. I couldn't get off the ship. I did spend $10 in the casino at Monte Carlo. You have to do that just so I could tell the story.
Sure.
In Spain, I have many days in Italy, and had a chance. I mean, if you look at the Vatican and you see the dome, and up at the top of the dome is that little cupola, I've stood in that. I've been underneath the main floor of the Vatican where the popes are interred. I've had a chance to walk to the top of the Leaning Tower of Pisa before they closed. You see, I mean, there's just, I'm Austrian. I love Italy. There's no Italian in me. I'm a mix of all kinds of things, but I don't think there's any Italian. But I love Italy because you can't be bored in Italy. You can go anywhere you want. You turn a corner, there's another building, another church. And I was born and raised Episcopalian. I'm not Catholic at all, but I love the architecture and the artwork and stuff like that. There's a statue in the Vatican. You come in the back door and you move, go to the left, and the feet stand about chest high, so it's probably a 6 or 8 foot tall statue. And I think it's some saint of travelers or something. But for good luck, everybody touches the foot. Well, there's no big toe left because of how many millions of people have just made one simple stroke.
Sure.
And, you know, that's something. I love that stuff. And I'm just...
all that a result of being deployed on Nevis. So.
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
We had great fun, did some fascinating things. One of my favorite pictures, I don't remember who the person was. They did a photo spread for Life magazine, and it was based on this red couch. And he would take the red couch to different locations and photograph it. He put it in a jail cell. He did a bunch of different things. Well, one of the places he put it was at the head of the pier with Nimitz in the background and my commanding officer sitting in the chair and in the couch. And so I saw the picture. I cut it out of the magazine. And when I was leaving the ship and having my out interview with the captain, I gave him the picture and asked him to sign it. So I have this autographed picture of my commanding officer sitting on the red couch.
That's great.
So, and he was a great guy. You know, every line officer I've ever worked for has been a fantastic individual. You know, all but a few of the dental officers I ever worked for were great. You know, so and those are some of the reasons why I stayed in.
Sure.
The people that I worked for just encouraged me. And hey, let's put you in for this class. Let's do that training. Let's send you here. And you know, they knew I was always willing to pack my sea bag. Sure.
When you were at Pendleton with the Marines, you were there for 3 years, did you say?
Four.
4 years. And you talked about, you mentioned something blue. Well, did you deploy with the Marines? Is that
no.
what you were saying?
My problem at that time was I was at the wrong rank. I was a lieutenant commander, and I was fairly senior. So you're not senior enough to take a group by yourself, you know, to be the commanding officer, but you're too senior to go out as one of the junior den officers. So that deployment wasn't going to happen. But there, while we were Greenside, we were officially attached to the Marines. So if the Marines left, we left. And after, again, during some other reorganization, a bunch of us were shifted back to the Navy support group, which was like the Navy hospital, Navy dental clinic. So then we were, we called Blue Side.
Okay.
You don't wear your camis anymore and that kind of thing. And it was right after that shift that the first Gulf War happened. And I'll probably never forget the day. Went home on one day, came back the next day, and the base was a ghost town. Every single Marine had been deployed, unbeknownst to everybody, overnight. And they were gone. And we had nothing to do for about a week, and then they began to refill the base with what they call combat replacement teams. And so, unfortunately, since I had shifted over to Blue Side, I wasn't deployed with the Green people.
And which you would have loved, obviously.
Oh, absolutely.
Sure.
Well, I went in every day asking my XO. I said, I can be packed in an hour. Can you send me something? I'm ready, you know. So,
do you think you were a sort of a throwback to the way Navy people are supposed to be, all of us, and that you were there to do what was the right thing? I've never heard of anybody who wanted to be out there and so active as yourself.
I always felt that I was, I don't like to use the word destiny so much, but I was always active. I loved Boy Scouts growing up. You know, we were always busy doing things. I love being busy. I like being out there. I feel that if you're properly trained and everything, your chances of getting injured are minimal. I'll tell you, well, when we were in Haiti, for instance, every time we would leave our little compound, we'd go out with a flak vest and a helmet, and many of us carried a weapon. And the command master chief said, you know, Commander, you really don't have to do this. You don't have to carry your weapon every time. I said, if you think that I'm going to hide behind a truck while I let somebody else protect me, that's not going to happen. I said, so I will go out armed and ready, as so will everybody else. And when Saturday morning rolls around and we all have to clean our weapons, you'll find me at the table cleaning my own weapon. Because I don't expect anybody to do that for me. And we established that relationship early on. And it was fine.
Sure.
And we never had to pull our weapons. But I have some pictures in here. We go to a remote site somewhere around the city of Port-au-Prince. And we'd get there right after lunch usually, and there'd be a line of hundreds of people waiting to see the dentist or the medical people. And we averaged 11.4 extractions an hour in two chairs. I had a couple of dental technician assistants and one hospital corpsman who wanted to help. And so the really, really easy stuff, the wiggly teeth they did, and the more difficult ones I did myself. But we would get to the site, and I would take off my helmet and take off my flak jacket, and I would take off the top blouse, and you get down to your brown T-shirt, and then I'd put my shoulder holster back on, and I'd put on sort of a Rambo thing to catch the perspiration, and a little headlight, and big blue gloves. And that's how I worked for the next 2.5 hours.
Wow.
And you would perspire so much. It was actually amazing. I could take my hands and hold them up in the air, and the water dripping down my arm was actually hot. But you got to do cool stuff and see things that you never saw. You saw only in textbooks. And you did some really nice stuff for some awesome people. You know, of all the places I've been in the world, I've never met a crummy person, a creepy person. You know, politics aside, people just want to be people. And you may not speak the same language, but you can certainly wave and shake their hand and, you know, buy them a glass of wine or share some, you know. And the Haitians were no less. You know, they were just nice people, genuinely appreciative of what we could do that they couldn't do for themselves. So.
Did you ever have any young, arrogant, maybe a guy a little bit younger than you who had a position of authority ask you to get out of his way? He thought you were usurping his, by getting too much involved with the line side as opposed to the dental side?
No, I always, just as you asked me when we came in the door, and you said, what do you want me to call you? And I said, my name is Kenneth. Ken is fine. I never stood too much on... Because on our uniforms, we had our core device on our left collar and our rank on our right collar. And I rarely had the wag on my right collar. I didn't use the word, that's an order, very often.
Sure.
But I also knew that my position, I'm a support person. I'm not an active person. And I had a great meeting one time at one of the branch clinics at Camp Pendleton as we were struggling to get dental readiness up, making sure that people weren't likely to have problems when they were deployed. So I asked the reps from each of the local units to come in. So they're sitting in my waiting room. I had my second-class petty officer, who was my senior person at the time, and I walked in, I introduced myself, and I said, now I want you to understand, I work for you. My job is to take care of your people. And that's all I'm going to say. I'll be in the clinic seeing your patients. And if you have a problem, you talk to Petty Officer Velasquez. And if she can't solve it, she'll come to me. And we'll get it done. And I had these corporals and sergeants with their mouth wide open. A lieutenant commander said that? But we had a great relationship. And because of that, we had super cooperation. You know, I love the chance to stand and steer the boat for a minute, but I don't want to be the helmsman.
Sure.
I love doing what I'm doing. It was great. There are times when I miss it. There are times when I wish I'd get that phone call at night. Could you pack up and go somewhere for a couple months? And knowing that that's not going to happen, but I don't know, maybe it was strange, or maybe I was unusual, but that's also probably the reason I wasn't promoted to captain, because I was not a sit-at-my-desk all-day, push-paper kind of person. I wanted to be out in the clinic. And even when I was the boss down in Cuba, when my boss would try and find me, my chief always said, he's out, he's working. He's out at one of the camps, he's over having a meeting, he's talking with this, he's inspecting a clinic, he's seeing patients, he's, you know. So
you're at Kings Bay now, as further on in your career,
okay. Mm-hmm.
And here comes Great Lakes in your future. So you had a decision to make, and that decision was, it sounds like, that you chose to retire with that 26 or 28-year fogey process.
Yeah, fogey, yeah, that's a good word. Haven't heard that one in a while. There was a fair amount of reluctance to it, but right before I went to Haiti, one of my patients said, you know, you really need to look down at this interesting little place on Amelia Island. And I thought I wasn't going to pay rent on somebody else's house for 6 months and not be there. So I found a nice little house here that I was able to afford to buy and put on automatic payment through the credit union. And so when I went off to Haiti, I came back and had a nice little house there. Wasn't expecting to get married, but that's another story.
That was here in Nassau County.
Right here in Fernandina.
In Fernandina.
Yeah. I mean, from this building, it's probably about 2 miles away. And it's... I came here and I just said, you know, of all the places that I've lived and visited around the world, this one felt really home to me. And I haven't for 2 seconds regretted that choice. So it was either go someplace very interesting and probably come back here, or retire and stay here.
So you came out of the Navy, and did you open up a practice here?
I worked for two or three different people over the course of about a year, and I won't get into the politics of that, but let's just say that I didn't work well with others, and we didn't get into any fights. but some of their leadership and management skills left a lot to be desired. And maybe I do have some somewhat strict ways about how you do things. You know, I was taught early in my Navy career that, particularly as a junior officer, if you're less than 10 minutes early, you're late. And you don't leave before the old man leaves. And whether you're in uniform or not, it's, you know, yes, sir, and all those kind of things. And that works real well. And you don't have to be a stickler for it. But training people to do their job and then letting them do their job is great. I apologize to a first-class petty officer that worked for me when I was in Cuba. And as he was leaving, and I'm trying to think of his name, but I said, I apologize to you. He said, why? He said, because you knew how to do your job. He was in charge of supply. I gave you the budget. You took care of business. I didn't have to mess with you at all. You're not going to find too many other people in the Navy who are going to do that. He goes, yeah, you're right. Yeah, and not to my surprise, he made chief a couple years later. But, you know, I always thought it was kind of interesting. They send you to some of these leadership courses, and then when you try and use it, you find that the micromanagers still want to micromanage it. And I will not micromanage, and I do not like being micromanaged.
How did, in addition to the admiral in Norfolk, the skipper of Nimitz, who were some other interesting people that you had high regard? It sounds like you had high regard for all of your shipmates.
Oh, I mean, when I was studying for the surface warfare pin, one of the things I had to learn different systems. So I went down to the water purification section, and there was seaman, whoever it was, who was in charge. And I said, teach me. And we spent an hour and a half him showing me the equipment. It was his equipment.
Sure.
He loved that machine. You could tell. It was clean. It worked. Who better to talk to than the guy who owns the machine? And when I was, I had to qualify as officer of the deck in port. So we'd get finished work. I'd put on my dress blues and I'd go out and stand there with somebody who was qualified, usually a first class petty officer. And here I am with my three stripes as a commander. And they're going, what are you doing here? Captain left the ship one day and he goes, what are you doing here? I said, I'm working on my qualifications. Unbelievable. and the person who's the expert in the area is the expert. And that philosophy always got me places. You know, you meet somebody. My roommate on Nimitz was one of the reactor officers who, he may be an admiral now too. I know he was a commanding officer of a ship a number of years ago. He's probably retired now, but he was a great guy. But he said, yeah, when we're in port sometime, we shut down the plant. I can't bring you through when it's active. Not that it's a radiation hazard, which it's not. But so when it was shut down, we walked through, gave me the tour. You know, it's like walking through a circulatory system. It's amazing. You know, the people who do their jobs that run the nuclear power plants, you know, there has never been, to my knowledge, even the smallest radiation leak in all of Navy nuclear power. Mm-hmm. And there was a story years ago when Admiral Rickover, the father of Navy nuclear power, they have a little gadget that they wear called a TLD, and if it's hit by radiation, it catches it, and then they record it every month to check your dose. And even the people that stand next to the reactors are always zero. It's so low that everybody, unless you're in the reactor room, you don't even wear one when you're on a ship like Nimitz. But apparently Admiral Rickover wore one when he took a tour of a Soviet nuclear power ship and had it read when he got back. And he said he got more radiation in that one tour than he got in his entire career of nuclear power. So,
amazing.
In case anybody's listening, I want to make sure you understand, Navy nuclear power is a awesome business when you have to stop at the gas station every 13 or 14 years and you can power a 95,000 ton ship about 29, 30 knots through the water. That's
amazing.
It
sounds like, Commander, you've had more highlights than the normal person in a wonderful Navy career. Is there any last minute items you'd like to tell us about? What an exciting time.
Oh, it was... Because of the Navy, I've been places and done things. I've been in cities around the country. I've had chances to... we used to... When we were in a new duty station, we would plan our vacations around that. So one of the summers when we were in Southern California, we went up and we hit like 10 or 11 national parks in a week. You know, Bryce Canyon and Grand Canyon, both sides. You know, all that stuff. I've been to cities that I never would have been to for meetings and training sessions and things. Had a chance to meet some amazing people and understand that when so many, when you read so many stories in the newspapers, so many editorials, different things, of people who have no clue of what, and I forget who said it, it might have been Jomini or Mayer, but, you know, war is an extension of politics, and none of us want to go there, but you better be darn ready in case you have to. And people think that it's fun and games. I met a guy yesterday, Special Forces Army guy, medically retired. This guy had been, I mean, he wouldn't tell me most of the places he'd been. Can't. But he's now waiting for a liver transplant because he got hepatitis while on one deployment. And he's a hero. You know, he's amazing to me. So we have these people around, and this is a great area. There are obviously you gentlemen, but we have a huge number of people with a lot of stories, you know, well know. And I hope they're doing the same thing out in Coronado, California, where there's a lot of retired people like that, too. You can go someplace. The only thing that comes close to the instantaneous friendship of military service, whether it's retired or just some time, is Boy Scouts. And you tell somebody you're an Eagle Scout, you're a friend for life forever. They don't even have to know you.
So, that's great.
You know, we had great fun, been to some fascinating countries, can't wait to go visit them, but you certainly learn when you visit a foreign country, even economically very nice ones, you know, Italy and Britain and I haven't been to too many, but they don't have anything close to what we have in this country. Now, in Italy, after a meal, you may be lucky enough to order a piece of fruit for dessert and pay a premium price for it. In this country, you can go to Publix and pick one of 7 different types of apples, 15 types of olives. And anybody who lives here can go do that. You don't have to be part of the Soviet elite to go into the superstore and buy peanut butter, you know. And if people would go on some of these deployments or some of these church missions when they get to go to places like Haiti and some of these other countries and see what's out there, not only can you help, which is great, but to see what these people do on a daily basis. In Haiti, if you want fresh meat, you better go pick it up because it's hanging up bleeding in the square. No refrigeration. And you better get it and you better cook it. And most of the people cook over a charcoal fire. We dealt with several children who had literally fallen into the barbecue, which, unlike here where it's 3 feet off the ground, theirs is right on the ground. And, you know, nasty. Burns. But that was their life. They lived on the side of the road. If they had a family of 4 in probably 20 or 30 square feet of living area, they considered that a lot of space. Not everybody. There were some nice places. But, you know, when you don't have anything in Haiti, you really don't have anything. And I wish people could go there and see that to appreciate what we have down here. The, you know,
yes, sir. And
philosophical.
Gentlemen, do you have any questions for Commander?
I'm curious if you remember the name of the Medal of Honor recipient that you met.
No, I don't. It was an Army gentleman. We did have a, I have the book at home, But I had a book on my shelf about Vietnam, and I knew this particular guy was coming in to speak to the class, and I brought the book in and had him autograph it. I'm not sure if he was the Medal of Honor winner or not, but one of the faculty members at the Marine Corps Command and Staff College had a Navy Cross from Way City.
I had a friend that was a Medal of Honor winner that lived in that area named Barney, and he was a Vietnam Marine.
The first name Barney doesn't ring a bell, yeah. But you know, we had
Barney Barnum.
Okay, yeah. That's not ringing a bell. We had a chance at one of my classes. They brought in a person who had been a prisoner of war in Vietnam, just like Tom McCain. And he described in excruciating detail what it's like to have your arms pulled behind your back and your arms tied together till your elbows meet and then hung up in the air. And all of these horrible, horrible things. And you know, when they talk about putting underwear on somebody's head as being torture, they don't understand. And what these brave, heroic people did and endured is way, way ahead of me going out on a ship and having a good time. You know, I always say I was on the fringe of combat. You know, you wear a little armor, you're alert, never got shot at, thank goodness. But
Commander, I can't thank you enough for coming in today and sharing this very interesting and exciting story of your great Navy career. Thank you, sir, for your service. We appreciate it very, very much. And thank you for sharing your recollections with me for the benefit of our nation. This concludes the interview with Commander Kenneth A. Mertz, Jr., Dental Corps, United States Navy, retired.